the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler, and if you've looked at the calendar, it is May, and that means that high school students are graduating this month and at the beginning of June, and coming this fall, many of them will want to go to college. You didn't think your little one would grow up that fast, did you? Well, guess what? For parents, they're going to be facing a major expense. According to the College Board, the average cost of tuition and fees for the 2017 to 2018 school year is close to $35,000 at a private university, $10,000 for in-state residents at a public university. And for a private college, overall, that could add up to more than $150,000 in tuition costs and up to $40,000 for a state university. It seems overwhelming and daunting.
And John, these are just average figures, but you know, if your son is a genius or your daughter's a genius and can get into, let's say, an A-rated school, for example, Harvard, in 2017-2018 school year, tuition and fees at Harvard are $46,000, and then you can add almost another $20,000 for room and board. So basically $66,000, which can add up to over $260,000 for just a four-year degree. So when we take these averages that a private education is $35,000 and a public university is $10,000, remember, these are averages. You want to go to a top-flight school, Harvard, University of Chicago, MIT, Stanford, Wharton, you're going to end up paying over $250,000 for a four-year degree. And, you know, that's just for one student. Imagine if you're a parent that have three kids that want to go on to college. So it's not just the cost of the education. In most cases, it's the debt that is incurred to pay for that education. Because how many of you listening to this program, let's say you had three bright kids who were capable of getting into Harvard. Well, those three kids, that's $750,000 or more for just three kids getting into a top A-rated school. Borrowing in this country, student loans now exceed $1.3 trillion with 44 million student loans outstanding. So more and more people are borrowing to pay for their college education. That $1.3 trillion translates into roughly over $37,000 per student. And here's the other thing. 66% of graduates from public universities have debt. That figure is even higher for those individuals attending private universities like a Harvard or a Stanford. 75% of the students attending private college have some form of debt. And I would suspect, John, I've seen the figures for private college. They're probably leaving those colleges with close to $100,000 in debt. And it's one of the reasons why you've seen fewer household formations, because let's say a young couple starting out, a husband and wife, can bring almost $100,000 of student loans into that marriage. That's not counting the car loans or, God forbid, you want to have money for a down payment on a house.
And Jim, you can see the conflict here, because about the time that the students get ready to go away to college, the parents are typically in middle age and they should be thinking about their retirement planning. And you look at the amount of debt that, you know, if they're co-signing a note with their children, the amount of debt can be a major setback in the retirement planning. According to government figures, for example, the average household is carrying about $140,000 in debt. And when it comes to student loans, then that just throws more on top of the weight. It takes students sometimes 10 to 20 years to pay off their loans.
Yeah. So you can imagine bringing into a marriage, let's say both the husband and the wife typically bring between $70,000 to $100,000 of debt. That's assuming they went to a public university. If they went to private school, that debt figure is even longer. And as you mentioned, that could take 10 to 20 years to pay off the student loans. Imagine you get married at 25 and you don't pay off your student loans to 45. And as you're paying off your student loans, your kids now are entering college and you're incurring debt. But that's not the worst of it. What if, after all the time and effort that you put into getting a college education, you graduate and can't get a job after graduation? The figures vary each year, but somewhere between anywhere from 20 to 40% of those graduating don't have jobs. You know, if you think of the paradigm, students are taught and they are given one path for life. One option in life is you go to school, go to college, you get a degree, and then when you get out, you get a job, and that job is going to pay you a lot more had you not gotten the degree. Here's the problem. Unfortunately, that is not what happens in the real world. If you take a look at reality, the economy is largely controlled by companies because we're a capitalistic society and the bulk of our GDP comes from private companies. They have the money and they have the jobs, and quite honestly, they are the ones that decide whether or not to hire you. If these companies don't need your skills or you don't have the degree or skills they need, then you are plain out of luck. Last year, there were 6 million jobs, high-paying jobs in the U.S., that were unfilled because the companies can't find the right workers or the students to fill those jobs. So before you plop down $100,000, or in the case of Harvard, $250,000 for a college education, here's the thing you have to think through first. Make sure you have a degree that is going to guarantee you a high probability of success of getting a job when you graduate. There are plenty, literally plenty of high-paying jobs waiting for the right graduates with the right education and the skills employers are looking for.
Let's see if we can put this in perspective for listeners, and this brings it back to the more realm of the pragmatic. What we're going to do is examine the top-paying jobs and rank them in terms of quality, I guess, and yield as far as income over time, and where they are to be found.
It's rather interesting because the Department of Labor, as of March, the figure has gone up to 6.6 million jobs that remain unfulfilled. And the St. Louis Federal Reserve reports that job vacancies are over 6 million in the private sector. So there are plenty of high-paying jobs out there. The problem is you have to have the right education and skill for those jobs. So there was a recent study that was published, and it's called the 50 Highest Paying Careers for College Graduates. I want to go over the top 10 because there's going to be a commonality between all of them, and I think it's real important if you have junior or you have a daughter that is thinking heading off to college and pursuing a degree. Number one job out there right now, this is going to surprise you, is petroleum engineering. The average salary ranges from $102,000 to $176,000. Petroleum engineers help locate basically natural reservoirs of petroleum deposits. They work with teams of specialists, and there are three types of petroleum engineers. There are ones that work at, let's say, the early stage of the drilling process that they're involved in, sort of, okay, where are we going to put the drills? Where is the oil? Then there's reservoir engineers that monitor the geological formation for the best strategic method of getting the oil out of the ground. And then there's what we call drilling engineers that generate computer-simulated models of the drilling formation and equipment to ensure the best tools and the most effective method of extraction. And then you have what is called production engineers that manage the interface between drilling, extracting the resource, and managing the machinery and the production. That's the number one job, $102,000 to $176,000. Number two job, actuarial mathematics. Sounds complicated, but basically an actuary analyzes the financial consequences of risk. They use mathematics, statistics, in financial theory to study uncertainty. Actuaries work for insurance companies. They work for consulting companies, government, employee benefit departments of large corporations. And basically, they manage risk. Anybody, you take out life insurance, whether it's car insurance, house insurance, life insurance, those premiums were determined by actuarial studies of probabilities of an event taking place. So that's the number two job. Number three job, nuclear engineering. This one kind of surprised me since we're moving away, at least in this country, from nuclear power plants. I know California is closing down its power plants. The average salary for a nuclear engineer is $67,000 to almost $120,000. Nuclear engineers do research, develop processes, instruments, and also don't forget medical uses. Have you ever had a CAT scan or proton beam radiation? That's a nuclear engineer that's involved with that. So that's the number three paying job. Number four, you're going to start to notice a pattern here. Chemical engineering. The salary ranges from $17,000 to almost $117,000. Chemical engineers are involved in design, development, construction, and operation of the industrial process for producing basically products. That could include oil and gas industry, the pharmaceutical industry, energy industry, water treatment, food and drink, plastics, toiletries, and also, don't forget, pioneering new materials and techniques, and things such as nanotechnology to fuel cells. That's the number four. Number five is electronic and communication engineering. The jobs range salary from $64,000 to $113,000. You're basically working with electric circuits and systems. And jobs can be found in the acoustics industry, defense, medical instruments, mobile phones, nanotechnology. Number six, this should be no surprise, computer science. Average salary starts at anywhere from $67,000 all the way to $112,000. This works in the development, everything from computer games, business applications, and software. A computer engineer typically works in office or laboratory designing programs or systems for companies or government. Number seven, aerospace engineer. Anywhere from $65,000 to $108,000. Basically, you're designing components of anything from spacecraft, satellites, aircraft, missiles, defense industry, the aircraft industry. I know my own daughter-in-law is a aeronautical engineer, got her master's degree, and it's amazing what these people get paid. Not only just starting out of college, but also if they go on to get a master's, they're making six figures. In number eight, electrical engineering. And the salaries here range from everything from $67,000 to almost $108,000. Number nine, material science engineering. And number 10 is physics. And the salaries are from $57,000 to $105,000. Some of the biggest areas for jobs, manufacturing, healthcare, and government. And I'm just going to go through these real quick, because when I read these to you, something is going to start to stand out. In the number 11 position is a statistician. In the number 12 position, mechanical engineer. 13, software engineer. 14, business and information technology. Here's one that was a surprise at number 15, an economist. Number 16, industrial engineer. 17, applied mathematician. Number 18, civil engineer. 19, mathematician. Number 20, biomedical engineer. John, of the 50 top jobs in this country, over 60% of them were involved in some way or another with engineering, and the others were computer science or some form of science. It could be medical science or science in general. So when you think about the world that we live in today, we live in a very technologically driven society. You take a look at the largest cap stocks on the stock exchange. Apple Computer is $6 away from being the first $1 trillion company in history. Amazon, worth over $500 billion. Facebook and Google. Where are the jobs? They're all science and technology.
Yeah, but what's really tragic, and you can see this now in the dilemma that a lot of millennials are in, is they're getting their degrees in things that aren't necessarily marketable, and the only place you can probably use it is in a university teaching or some similar setting or certain foundations, but that's an incredibly limited amount of jobs, and so they're having difficulty finding work.
Yeah, they go to school. They might have got a bachelor's degree. Some, as a result of the Great Recession, went on, stayed in college, got a master's degree. The problem is their degrees, there's no openings for the jobs or the degrees that they're getting in. And I blame the colleges to some extent, because colleges should be looking at what are we offering students that are going to allow them not only to, you know, finance their education, but then pay those loans off because they'll have a good paying job when they get out of school. So you're starting to see now alternatives to, let's say, getting a college degree. We talked about on the weekend program last week where in towns like Elkhart, Indiana, you have high school students, instead of choosing to go to college and incur debt, are going to work on an assembly line in a factory making RVs and making $90,000 a year with no debt. You are starting to see companies work with junior colleges and develop two-year programs where you specialize, especially in today's manufacturing, where it's not going to be Larry Moe and Curly attaching a bumper to a car. It's going to be some guy with a lab coat that's operating a $25 million robot. He's going to have coding skills, engineering skills, math skills. Those are the things that are going to get you a high-paying job, and that's where those 6.6 million jobs are today. And just imagine, if you're a parent, or let's say you're a millennial listening to this program, imagine getting out of college, you're living in a high-cost state like California or a big city like New York City, Chicago, Boston, Los Angeles, San Francisco. Imagine getting a job in moving to an area of the country, let's say it's Indiana, it's Nebraska, it's Iowa, it's Texas. And when you get out of college, the town that you're moving to is going to pay you anywhere from $5,000 to $15,000 just to move to the town. And when you get to that town, you're going to have a high-paying job. So, number one, you're getting paid to move. Number two, you're going to move to a place where the cost of living is substantially cheaper. Number three, you're going to move to a place where there's either no taxes or low taxes. And number four, you're going to have a high-paying job. Now, contrast that to living in a large city, attending a college, coming out of college with tens of thousands, if not $100,000 of debt, and getting out of college and having no job.
And this is quite a contrast from what we just discussed earlier, because you have companies, there are what, about 6.6 million jobs available out there, and the companies can't find the workers to fill the jobs, contrasting people who have what we would call, I guess, useless degrees, who can't find jobs.
Yeah, and there's another way to rethink about it, and we're using this in our own firm. We have, in our firm right now, we have three interns. They're all getting a financial degree. Two of them will be sitting for the Certified Financial Planner designation, and they will get that designation when they graduate because they will have had 3 to 4 years worth of experience. You just can't sit for the exam and pass all the tests, that you have to have on-the-job experience of being in the field. So they are actually working in the field. Two of our interns are staying at home. Two of them went to a junior college while staying at home. They had no debt. They were getting paid $15 an hour to work in our firm. So they had a job. They were getting on-the-job training. They were living at home. And now two of them are at the state universities. They will graduate with, number one, no debt. Number two, they actually have a 401k and they have savings in the bank versus incurring debt. Number three, as soon as they sit for their certified financial planner exam, they will be able to get that certificate because they will have the 3 or 4 year experience that is required to get the certificate. So they get out of school, they have a job, they get their certification. You contrast that to people that go away to school, have to pay room and board, and get out of school. They have a lot of debt, and they don't have a job.
You know, there was a time when you could just show up at almost any job and say, I had a college degree, and that was an entry in the door, even if the college degree wasn't directly related to what it was you're going to be doing. But this is a whole shifting paradigm, both for parents and for students, and they really need to ask themselves, what are the jobs that are out there that I want to get so that I know what degree to go after in order to get those jobs?
Yeah, because you might want to start talking to companies, researching what kind of jobs are out there, what kind of skills are required, what the companies are looking for. Start networking, developing a program on campus. And the other thing you might want to do is see if you can get an internship. I know I had one son that was going to be a biochemist, and he had a summer internship at Pfizer in their research lab. So he was getting on-the-job experience while he was attending college. And it's just like the interns that we have in our company. They are actually getting on-the-job experience, and they're choosing to live at home. So when they graduate, they'll have a bankable savings account, they'll have a 401k, and they'll have a job, and they'll get their certification. You contrast that. So, John, the first thing you want to do today is look at the jobs. Where are the jobs? What are the skills? What's the education required? What kind of degrees and education are companies looking for? Number two, if you can afford it and you can live it and it works out with your parents, try to go to a junior college. Because, you know, I went to junior college and then I went on to Arizona State. My degree from Arizona State didn't say a half degree. It said Arizona State. I graduated with honors. But I went to a junior college. It's hard to believe this today, but my tuition was $45 a semester for a full-time student. It cost me $180 to get a 2-year degree. But stay at home, go to a junior college, and then go to a state college. Because if you get a degree in engineering and you find out that's where the jobs are, if you can do that in state, it's going to be a lot cheaper. And if you can do the first 2 years at a junior college, it's going to be not only cheaper on you, but for you parents who are listening, imagine sending junior stays at home, goes to a junior college at $2,500 or $2,600 a year instead of $10,000, and then goes to, let's say, a local university at $10,000 a year instead of out of state at $20,000, or a private school at $40,000, $50,000, or $60,000. And then, if you can, as much as possible, whatever field that you've chose, you want to start talking to companies while you're in college. And as much as possible, if there's any kind of company in the field you want to go into that is located in where you're going to school or where you live, try to get an internship with them, even if you have to volunteer, so you have work experience on your resume. It gives you a higher probability of success in getting a job once you get out. And more importantly, you're going to start out life with zero debt. All of our interns that are working for us now, John, none of them will have a dollar of debt when they get out of school, because they're making enough working for us as interns to pay for their college, and they're living at home.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, Karen Covey's Jim's guest. She's a specialist in divorce. And if you're thinking about it, we hope not, but if you are, you really need to know what the tax laws, the new tax laws, do to people who pay alimony and who are involved in this whole process. A lot has changed. Okay, time for the real life case study, which of course is an hypothetical illustration based on real life examples. Names and circumstances have been changed, and we always have slides online at financialsense.com to illustrate the points being made. And today, of course, we're talking about planning for a college career that works at the very same time that is your kid's college career, at the very same time you're planning for retirement.
This is the case of Keith and Valerie Coyle. Keith is 48, Valerie's 47. Both plan on retiring in about 50 years, probably a little bit longer because they want to get their full Social Security benefits, which will be age 67 by the time they retire. Valerie has a lot more life expectancy. She's expected to live to age 92, given her health questionnaire. Keith, 88. Even though they're still in their 40s, their risk tolerance is somewhat moderate. They got burned in that last downturn in 2008 where they saw a lot of their 401k. They lost over half of it in that downturn. Remember, the S&P 500 lost almost 60%. Keith is an engineer. With the amount of working hours he puts in a week to week as an engineer, he's left his wife with the responsibility of managing the household finances. He has a high value for education, obviously, with being an engineer, and wants both his kids to get a good private college. Now, here's the question. Private college, when the time comes, Keith and his wife have about $200,000 saved in a taxable account that they could use for their kids' college. However, their concern is that if they use the principal, it will diminish their ability to retire sooner. In other words, if they consume all their savings, what are they going to have for retirement? So college planning and retirement is sort of a joint goal here. Valerie is a homemaker. She's enjoyed a quieter life. She's a stay-at-home mom. She manages the budget and she pays the bills. And with the expenses that are coming up with maintaining a home and also living comfortably, the real thing that they're both thinking about, hey, we're going to retire in 15, 16 years, but we also have a couple kids that we want to get a top-notch private education, which is what they both got. Taking a look at their risk scores, this is one of the few cases where their risk managed how they were managing their portfolio. Both of them are very, very conservative and became very conservative, especially after what happened to them in the last downturn between 2007 and 2009, where they lost half their retirement savings. And they said, we don't want to go through that again. And remember, folks, the Fed is raising interest rates and we're more likely to go through another recession and bear market. So they were fairly conservatively investing. So what was important to both of them? Having enough assets to retire and finding the best education for their kids. So there was kind of two conflicting goals here. How do we pay for a private education and at the same time have enough money that we can retire comfortably when it comes time to our own retirement? So college in retirement with the two big goals. Total expenses were roughly about $115,000. Keith's salary was $150,000. So there was a surplus of almost $40,000 a year, which they were saving. Not only was Keith putting in his 401k program at work, and he was getting matching contributions, but also they were saving personally because they wanted to be able to retire. But more importantly, they wanted to have the ability to pay for those college expenses. They figured their retirement budget would get down closer to $100,000. At that time, their pension from Social Security would be close to 40, and Keith's pension would be roughly over 50. So they would have close to $100,000 of pension income coming in from his company's pension and also their Social Security with the shortfall of $21,000. Their residence was $400,000, of which they owed a mortgage roughly about $130,000. Keith's retirement account was roughly over $500,000. Valerie's IRAs were worth over $100,000, and they had almost $225,000 saved up in their personal assets, which they weren't quite sure whether it was going to go to education, how much of it was going to be left over for retirement. They don't want to change their lifestyle, but they felt that for going for a private school education, that was going to be $200,000 a year. So basically, they only had one kid's education paid for. Basically, what we did is we took their portfolio and we moved it a lot more towards treasuries, short-term notes, a little bit more on the bond side, especially since we're probably in the next 12 to 18 months, we'll be heading into a recession and bear market. And based on what their assets were right now, we basically said, look, you're going to have more than enough income to retire, assuming we're going to be able to pay for college. So the real big issue here was, how are we going to pay for college? What we advised them to do was set up a 529 plan for each one of their two kids. And the reason we did that is the 529 plan would allow them to save additional money that would be tax-free when their kids go to college. Because right now, everything they had on the personal side was taxable. They were paying taxes at almost a 40% bracket when you combine state and federal taxes. And so with Keith's recent raise, we recommended he max out his 401k program, and also both of them start putting money aside for their college education. The other thing I told Keith is, I said, look, if your kids are going to go on and get a degree like you did in engineering, go to, let's say, some of the top schools here in California, and we have some really great universities here, it really doesn't matter if they go to UC Davis the last 2 years of their college and go to a junior college, staying at home those first 2 years, because you can put them through a junior college and it'll cost you a little over $5,000. So, you know, we talked about this 2+2, and so they're still debating that, but they're leaning more towards that when they realize how much money they can save by going through that. So based on their current situation, we recommended they lowered their expenses, put some money aside for a 529 plan, and then also take a look at, let's say, local colleges for an education that can bring down that total cost over a period of time and make it much, much less for putting two kids through school.
And coming up again tomorrow, Karen Covey is on the program, specialist in divorce. And Jim, you really need to tell people why this is so important now. The new tax laws have put some radical changes in here, and some people are getting sort of sticker shocked, so to speak.
Yeah, this is going to be a real important show if you are in a difficult situation with your spouse. I can tell you guys, kiss and make up, because the new tax laws are very unfavorable for anybody that's getting divorced paying alimony beginning in 2019. Let me just give you a real world example that may take place with one of my clients' children. Junior, in this case, makes close to $200,000 a year. And California being a community property state, the wife would get half of that, roughly about $100,000 in alimony. Now, here's the problem. Under the current law, if the husband, let's say they go through a divorce, husband makes $200,000, he pays $100,000 to his ex-wife. The $100,000 he pays to his ex-wife is a tax deduction on his tax return. So he would report income of $200,000. He would get a tax deduction for the $100,000 he paid in alimony, and the ex-wife would report the $100,000 on her tax return, and she would pay the tax. Listen to this one. It's going to shock you. Next year, same situation, $200,000, $100,000 paid in alimony, zero, zip, deduction for the $100,000. Not only will the husband pay the $100,000 in alimony, he will also pay the tax on that alimony. So in this case, on a $200,000 income, the taxes would be $60,000. So the husband making $200,000 a year would pay $100,000 in alimony, $60,000 in taxes. So on a $200,000 salary, he would have $40,000 take home. So you're really going to want to listen to the show that we're going to do tomorrow, because this new tax law really makes it unfavorable to get a divorce, and especially if it occurs early on, when you're not only saving for a child's education, but also saving for your own retirement, it will change your life. I hope you have the time to listen to tomorrow's program. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.